My name's Red, and I am an alcoholic. It's by the grace of God, 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And most importantly, with the help of you people, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to take a drink since December 1st, 1986. And for that, I am eternally grateful. I had absolutely no idea of ever getting this sober when I came through the doors. In fact, I didn't come here to get sober. I came here to try to figure out how to lie my way out of trouble. Lying's been a big part of my life. You'll find that out in the next hour and a half to 2 hours. That's how long we've got, I think. I needed a way to lie myself out of trouble because I'd gotten myself into more trouble than I'd ever been in before. And I thought if I came into these rooms, maybe I could take time to find out. And while I was here, I caught this thing called alcoholism. And here I am. And it's 34 years later, and by the grace of God, as I said, and with the help of you people in that program, I haven't found necessary to take that drink. And I've watched a lot of people in here come and go and that haven't been able to say that. So I'm one of the few chosen, and so are you. We're all lucky to be here tonight in one way or another. None of us, you know, lived a perfect life when we walk through these doors. And for those of you that are new, under a year and you're here, let me tell you, I was 3 years before I went to my first roundup. So I applaud you. That's a big step in putting time into your recovery. I want to thank the committee and the trustees and for selecting Joy and I to come up here and tell our story. It's certainly an honor. It's always an honor and a privilege when you get to share your story with other people and to get to share your weekend with other people in the program. What a wonderful opportunity. I wanted to thank especially Scott for staying in touch with us over the last few months and keeping abreast of what's going on and what we needed to do and where we needed to be. And you've all been very gracious to us. Looking forward to hearing Anka speak and Bill and Joy, especially Joy. Joy's my favorite speaker of the weekend, and if I don't say that, then I'll be sleeping someplace else tonight. So yes, Joy is my better half, and she'll be speaking on Sunday. So we certainly appreciate that. I want you to know that everything I say is strictly my opinion, based on my experience in this program, and it's not necessarily that of this roundup or of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. It's just my interpretation of the truth and the faults since I've been here and how I see it. I say that because I've not always told the truth from this podium. I have lied. I talked to my sponsor this week. He requires me to do a couple of things. One is to wear a coat and tie, check. The other one is to tell you about the time that I was in prison. And so I'm going to do that. But if you don't mind, I'm going to get rid of the coat because he didn't say I had to wear it all night. I just had to wear it up here. I was about 2 years into the program in Georgia. I just moved to Georgia, and I got asked to tell my story out of prison. And I hopped in the car and started heading for the prison. And on the way over to the prison, it occurred to me that I've never been to prison. I've got some jail time, about 15 minutes. And didn't learn a lot during that 15 minutes about prison life. But I heard a couple of stories from guys in the program about when they were in prison. And one of them was in Attica during the Attica riots. And the other one was in Georgia. And I thought, those guys had great prison stories. And it occurred to me that with the people I was going to speak to in the prison, they needed to hear a good prison story. So I slowly, on my way over there, it was about an hour and a half drive, I assembled a really wonderful prison story. I interweaved my story with those other two guys, and I put together this wonderful story about how I got sober in prison and started an AA meeting and sponsored other people and carried the message. And even when it came time for me to get out of prison, I didn't leave early. I stayed longer just so I could help finish out the program with people. Now, when it was all over with, we didn't have cell phones then, and I got back home. My sponsor called me later that night, and he said, "How did things go at the prison?" And I said, "Oh, well, great." He said, "How was your story?" I said, "Wonderful." He said, did everybody come up and hug you when it was all over with? And I said, well, no, but it's a prison. They're probably not allowed to touch people from the outside. And he said, no, I've told my story there. They're allowed to touch you. And I said, well, they didn't come up and talk to me. He said, well, what is it that you said? And I said, well, I just told my story. And he says, you didn't lie to them, did you? No. He said, please tell me you didn't tell them you'd been to prison before. Yeah. And he says, oh, so you just lied to them. Yeah. Why? Well, it was for their benefit. I mean, I was doing it for them. And he's like, no, it was all ego. Yeah. So he said, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to call the facilitator of that meeting and let her know that you're coming back. And this time you're going to tell the truth. And it's like, nah, not going to do that. Yeah, you are. Now, what I didn't understand at that point, I had about 2 years, as I said, and I didn't understand that your sponsor couldn't hurt you or anything, you know. I was afraid of what he was going to do if I didn't do what he said, so I went back, and I did. I told my story, and I told the truth. I told them that I lied, told them why I lied, and when it was all over with, I got a nice round of applause, and everybody came up and hugged me afterwards. I don't know if it was they were feeling sorry for me or what, but they came back, and one guy raised his hand. He says, I have a question for you. And certainly, what can I help you with? Because I'm a helpful guy. And he said, why would anyone try to impress us by being in prison? We're all here in prison. That does not impress us, you know. What impresses us is what you do on the outside. I never knew that. But I lied because that's what I knew how to do when I got here. I learned how to lie my way through everything. And it was much easier to lie sometimes than tell the truth. And if I didn't have a story, I could make one up. I was good at telling stories. And that's who I was when I walked through these doors. And I continued to do that for a while. You'll find out I continued to do it for quite some time. I started drinking at a very early age. My first recollection of being in trouble with alcohol was at 12 years old. I was put in the hospital for alcohol poisoning. I drank a gallon of wine, hot. And what I found out was, by that experience, is don't drink wine hot. I mean, obviously that was the problem. Someone said a 12-year-old shouldn't consume that much alcohol. I didn't know if that was right or not, but I certainly knew that next time I was not going to drink hot wine. I continued to get drunk and continued to get in trouble at that age and on up into high school. In high school, I got into a good bit of trouble, enough trouble that my principal called my father and said, your son should either go to jail or into the service, and I'll give you the week to think about it. And I joined the U.S. Navy, much like this, to get out of the trouble that I was in. You know, it was not my intention to go out and be, you know, a veteran. It was just my intention to get out of trouble, and that's what I chose to do. Now, I joined the Navy. And if you've ever heard of drunken sailor, that was where I was. That's what I was doing. I stayed drunk most of the time that I was in there. So did everybody I was with. It was a popular thing to do. We found ways to drink on board ship, even at sea. And so I kind of drank my way through. Didn't achieve a whole lot. And when I got out, went back to my older ways of drinking and carrying on. When I got out, I had the GI Bill, and there was a new girl, and I was from a real small town, a little bit smaller than Montego, and there was this new girl in town. She was a hairstylist, a good-looking girl, and I introduced myself to her and tried to get to be her friend, and she only hung out with people that were in the hairstyling business. Back then it was beauticians, but anyway. And there was a movie out then called Shampoo. There a few of you may remember it, but it had Warren Beatty in it. And the premise of the movie was basically this young, good-looking guy riding around on a motorcycle with a hairdryer stuffed in his belt, and he would go over to these beautiful housewives' houses, and he would style their hair and make love to them and move on. And I thought, I like hair dryers. And so I decided that I was going to become a beautician. Signed up for the GI Bill. and got approved to go to school, got drunk, got into a really bad car accident, and couldn't go to school. And it was out for a while. I broke a bunch of stuff and tore myself up pretty good. And I didn't go to school, but when I was kind of healed up and able to get out and start doing things again, I had a choice. I could tell them I didn't go to school, or I could lie. I did the only natural thing for me to do. I lied and said, of course I went to school. And I graduated and went over to this girl, and she was so proud of me. And a few of my friends would come in, and I'd cut their hair. And not great, but, you know, this was in the 70s, you know, and so everybody's hair was kind of funky looking anyway, and it didn't really matter. And so I cut some hair and, you know, learned a few tricks, colored a few people. That didn't go well. I used to have red hair, in case you didn't know why the name was red. But at that point in time, my beard was blonde. And I wanted to have a red mustache, so I allowed this girl to dye my mustache red. But she messed up, and instead of dyeing my mustache red, she dyed my lip red. And so I went around for a month and a half with this red henna on my lip and white hair on top of it. It looked terrible. But anyway, so I started telling people that I had passed. I was cutting hair. I was, you know, living the life. And the thing about it, people start asking you questions. Well, tell me about your school. Oh, well, there were seven of us in the class. Really? Yeah. And I knew their names. And I could tell you about the classroom, what it looked like, and what our instructor was like, a little old lady. She was really sweet, bluish hair. And so I every time somebody asked, I added a little bit more to this lie, and I embellished upon it. The problem is, over time, I told it for many, many years when people would ask. About 40 years later, Joy and I are driving through this town, and she says, hey, Red, take me over and show me where you went to hairstyling school. Now, I'm, at this point, 28, 29 years sober, and I pull up to the stop sign and say, okay. And I go, gee, I don't know. And I've got to look at her and go, you know, I never really went to school. And she's like, what? You know, and I said, you know, I mean, I well, what? So you're lying? Yeah, pretty much, yeah. But the thing is, I told it for so long that I began to believe it. Now, that's a bit of a funny story, but for me, the thing is, there's a lot in my life that I looked at from one point of view, that I saw from one side, the drunken side, that the longer I'm sober, things start to clear up a little bit, and I go, that really wasn't quite that way. Maybe that person didn't really do that to me. Maybe that job wasn't quite as bad as I thought it was. You know, there's a lot of things that I twisted to make them suit me and my lifestyle. And you know, when you go home and you want to complain about work, you got to have something to complain about. You can't go home if you had a great day and complain. So you make stuff up, or you embellish, or you make it worse than it actually was. And that's what I did. I did that for a lot of years. I did the same thing with my resentments towards people. You know, you might have accidentally bumped into me at the store, but by the time I got to it, 6 months later, you know, you hit me with a baseball bat, and it's unforgivable. And so I carried that attitude and that method of dealing with things, that drunken behavior, right into all my relationships, and that doesn't buy well, I will tell you. In part of my journey to stay sober, I tried Amway. And Amway won't get you sober. It'll get you a lot of things, but it won't get you sober. I tried the Methodist Church, the Baptist Church, and the Catholic Church, none of which would keep me sober. I later joined several other fraternities, and they didn't keep me sober. Find out that, you know, I'm the problem, and it's not all these other things. Different wives. I did that a little bit. Different towns, different jobs. I've switched around, moved around. Different alcohol. I've done everything that you hear in the book, and none of that necessarily works. But there came a point where My drinking was starting to interfere with my job, and I had a good job at the time. I worked in the aerospace business, and I was sent to see this counselor, and she said that I needed to limit my drinking. She said 2 beers a day, and I explained to her that I lived 3 beers from work, and so I had to have 3 to get home right off the bat. And yes, that meant that I was drinking and driving, but that never came to mind, actually. But so I lived 3 beers from home because I had a 2 6-pack yard. You know, that's how long it, it took 2 6-packs to cut my grass. I knew that. And so she finally agreed. She said, if you're an alcoholic, three beers a day won't be a problem. You'll either not be able to do it or you will. So the first week was tough. But I made 7 days on 3 beers a day. On about the 8th or 9th day, I was on my way home from work, and I stopped in at my favorite little convenience store to pick up my 3 beers, and they had this new display case of alcohol, beer out. I drank Miller Lite at the time, and it was full of Miller Lite cans, and they were 1-quart cans. And I said, 3 cans of beer, right? I mean, that's what she said. She didn't say how much beer. She just said 3 cans, and so now I got 3 quarts. Just makes life easier. And so I started drinking the 3 quarts a day, and I went in to see her after 2 weeks, and she says, how's it going? It's going wonderful, not having any problems. She said, so you're limiting yourself. I said, 3 cans a day, just like you told me. She's like, well, that's really good. Yes, ma'am. She said, well, I'll see you in 2 weeks. Well, in 2 weeks, I came back, and I'm pretty much doing the same thing. But 4th of July came up. And 4th of July is a great day to drink with all your buddies and have a good time. And we had a nice spread out in South Louisiana, and people always came to our house, bless you. So Friday, people were coming over, and I drank my 3 beers on Friday, but I finished my 3 beers. It's like 9 o'clock, and there's still people hanging out. And so I went ahead and had one of Saturdays. I drank one of Saturday's beers because it's, I'm not the brightest guy, but 3 beers a day is 21 a week, and that's what she meant. She meant 21 a week. She didn't really mean 3 a day, just as long as I limit it to 21 a week. And so I had that other beer I had 4 on Saturday, on Friday, and then I only left 2 on Saturday, though. So I went ahead and drank Sundays on Saturday, and that was working out okay, and I continued to do that. But in about a month's time, I couldn't remember what month I was drinking out of. Is this October beer or November beer, And so I determined, based on my wonderful performance at 21 a week or so many a month, that I didn't need to go back and see her anymore. And I went in and saw her and told her the experiment was going so well that I didn't need to come back. And she said, you might want to go to meetings. And I didn't think so. But my supervisor just got sober. He had done a lot of terrible, rotten things at home and at work. And he got sober, and everybody thought he was a genius all of a sudden. And he insisted that I get sober. And I wasn't okay with that. And by now it's Christmas time. And the company Christmas party, I asked his wife to dance. And after about a half a fifth of liquor, I did his 5th step with her and told her about everybody he'd ever slept with and everybody he'd ever done, anything he'd ever done, and about all of the money he'd lost on a theory that if he got in that much trouble, he'd get drunk and I could go back to being a drunk, And he didn't. And they didn't get divorced right away. And so he transferred me out of the department. And I wound up going from New Orleans to Orlando into a different part of the aerospace business and showed up on the job out there. I was an engineer, and I couldn't write because my hands shook so bad from drinking. And I would go out at lunch and drink a pitcher of beer and come back, and then I could write. But steady hands is important when you're a draftsman, and my hands weren't all that steady. So I make it another 6 months or so once I'm out there, and I go home for Thanksgiving, and I didn't want to go home for Thanksgiving. At that time, I was a Shriner, and I was a Shriner clown, believe that or not. And so I knew that if I went back, in New Orleans, the Shrine Circus is on Thanksgiving weekend, and I knew if I went back, I'd wind up at the circus. If I wound up at the circus, I'd start drinking. If I started drinking, I'd get drunk and I'd miss work on Monday. Of course, Thanksgiving is Thursday, but you know, I already knew that if I got drunk on Thursday, I wasn't making it to work on Monday because that's who I was. And so we went back, explained to my wife, I can't go to the circus. She says, oh, it'll be fine. We'll sit up at the very top. We sat at the top. Two clowns came up, said, hey, Red, come on. I put on a costume. We did three shows a day for the next 4 days. And I got a whole lot of pictures of me and children as a clown, or me dressed as a clown with children that I don't remember taking any of. I was in a blackout the entire time. I wake up on Monday morning. I wake up naked in my sister-in-law's bed on Monday morning, and no one's speaking to me. And at that time, my wife was Spanish, and they spoke Spanish, and I don't speak Spanish, you know, but I know one word, and it's rojo, and that's red. And they were saying that about every fifth word, you know, and they were angry. And I thought, I'm a drunk. You know, I'm not the most faithful guy in the world. It's my sister-in-law's room. You know, what did I do? Oh, my goodness. You know, I felt pretty bad about it. Now, I was supposed to be at work on Monday, too, but I didn't make it. I called him and told him I had the 24-hour chicken pox. And in case you haven't guessed, that's not true. there's no such thing as 24-hour chicken pox. So I told him I had the 24-hour chicken pox and that I'd be into work tomorrow, and I got on a plane Tuesday morning. Now, on the way to the airport, my wife said something to me she'd never said to me before. She said, you ought to think about your drinking. And that's the only thing she said to me. But she'd never asked me to think about it before. She'd always yelled and screamed and hollered and gave me reason to fight back. And I had no reason to fight back. She wasn't being angry. She wasn't doing anything but telling me to think. And I thought, it's unfair to ask an alcoholic with a hangover to think about something, because that's all we do. And I thought all the way back. I didn't have a drink on the plane. When I got off the plane, I remembered Jim, my supervisor at the time. And he got drunk, did some terrible things, checked into treatment, and everybody forgave him. Hello, work, I need treatment. And they said, you know, we'll send you some information in the mail. And I said, no, it needs to be quicker than that. And she said, okay, drop by and see me next week, quicker than that. She said, well, you can come in tomorrow, faster than that. Where are you? And I said, I'm standing in front of a liquor store. And she said, go to the end of the street, take a right, go 10 miles, take a left into the hospital parking lot, they'll be waiting for you. And I checked into Orlando General Hospital, and that was December 2nd, 1986. And I haven't had a drink since then, but I didn't jump in there, as I had said, with the idea that I was going to get sober, but just that I was going to learn how to lie my way out of the trouble I was in. I'd been at trouble at home before, but never at home and at work at the same time. And now that was true. Before I forget to tell you, my sister-in-law was she had asthma. And her asthma medicine was in her bedroom. And I'd gone into her bedroom, locked the door, and went to sleep. And they had to take her to the hospital to get asthma medicine. So they were mad about having to take her to the hospital, not about what I thought I did. It was 6 months before anybody told me, so it was a really rough 6 months. And I sweated it out, and so I didn't do what I had thought I was capable, or did, but I knew I was capable of doing that. In getting sober, I did a lot of things then to try I did the 90 and 90. I was living separate from my wife at the time, and we were trying to put our relationship back together, but that wasn't coming out too well, and ultimately, I moved back to New Orleans to try and hold it together, quit my job, and that didn't work, and so I moved to Georgia. And when I got to Georgia, I started going back to AA meetings, and I met a girl in Al-Anon, and fell head over heels. She had a nice hair dryer as well, so that didn't go real well. After about a year, she decided that, I was more of a stalker than a boyfriend, and she didn't want to go out with me anymore. And I was devastated. I was devastated. I'd been physically sick at the same time. And I think I will tell you today that I believe that I was spiritually sick, and that's what made me physically sick. But at the time, I didn't know that. And so I was really physically sick. They had said that I had, my lifetime was limited based on what was going on. And I was sponsoring people. Now, I got to tell you, in this whole time, now we're at about 3.5 years sober, I'm sponsoring a lot of people. They're all getting drunk, but I'm sponsoring them. Now, I didn't know how to work the program. If you looked at my big book at the time, it sat on my ironing board, and the iron sat on top of it. So there's a big imprint of an iron on my first big book. And that's all I knew about it. I'd been to a big book study. Those people, all they do is talk about that damn big book. And I don't have any new thinking. Just the same old stuff that was written back in 1939. It's like, come on, folks, you know, come up with something new. And so I didn't want anything to do with big book studies. But this guy I was sponsoring had 6 months in the program. And I had decided to commit suicide. And I was sitting at home with a gun trying to go from sympathy suicide, which is where you tell everybody you're going to kill yourself, to actually killing myself. And his name was Frank. And Frank called me and said, hey, I just got back from this Joe and Charlie Big Book study. And everything you've ever told me is wrong. And I want to come tell you about the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's like, Frank, I'm busy. And Frank says, nope, I'm coming over. Frank had a car phone. The only guy I knew that had one. And he called me and said, he's coming over. And so it's like, okay, come on over. And Frank came over and he walked me through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous in about 2.5 hours. I'd never heard it before. Had absolutely no idea what it was about. I didn't know it was in the book. Amazingly enough, they had it in there. And it was just behind the iron print. And so obviously I didn't commit suicide. And it started changing the way I started doing things. I started going to big book studies. I started getting involved in the program. I got a new sponsor. Now, I'm getting better, but not great. I asked a guy to be my sponsor, mainly because his wife was sponsoring the girl that I wanted to go out with. And I thought that if he saw how wonderful I was, he'd tell his wife would tell her, we'd get back together, it'd all be wonderful, you know. Didn't work out that way, because the first thing we did when we got to my fifth step, he says, now tell me about why I'm your sponsor. I'm like, well, because you're a great guy, Russ. He goes, no, because I'm married to Donna, and you think Donna's going to get, and it's not going to happen. Like, ugh. So somebody else saw through my lies. But I started working the program and started doing the things that he insisted that I do. And little things like make up your bed in the morning. You got to make your bed every day. Doesn't matter why. Just do it. It's the first thing you do every day. You get out of bed and you make it. And he said, over time, you'll feel good about that. And when you don't make it, you'll feel lousy about it. And he's right. I make up my bed. Joy and I have a deal. Last one in bed makes it up. Now, I try and get up early so I don't have to do it. But if I'm the last one in bed, I make it up, because that's what we do. And it's a part of how we stay sober, I guess. I'm going to a lot of big book studies now. I'm more involved in the program. I am doing service work. And this beautiful blonde-haired girl pulls up in a 1970 Cutlass convertible. And I won't tell you how she's dressed, but she's learned not to dress that way. But it caught my eye. And I asked her to marry me, which is typical for me. I said, I'll marry you if you put your car in my name. She just smiled and said, well, we're not getting married. But we became friends. And we started hanging out together and talking together and going to meetings together. And we went to the Atlanta Roundup once together. And over time, we became good friends, and then we started to date. Now, that's new for me. It's new for me to even know somebody's last name before they move in. But with her, I did. I got to meet her and got to know a little something about her and got to decide that, I actually like this person. And so we got married. And we started out, we had children that we put 3 children through treatment centers, a couple through prison, 1 through jail, and 2 through college. So we worked the gamut. But we managed to stay sober ourselves through all of that. And we did that by working this 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, what's in that first 164 pages, by hanging out with you people and being of service, by having a sponsor and sponsoring other people. And that's what kept us sober. That's what kept us able to go through the trials and tribulations that we went through. We We did well together. We left Marietta, Georgia, moved up to Ellijay, which is actually where we are right at this moment. And at that point, I've now got about 18 years in the program and have become very successful at what I did. And became sort of notable. People all over town and all over that portion of Georgia, if not the state of Georgia, knew who I was. I was flying back and forth to Washington. I was the man of the hour. And as your ego grows, so does your head. And I like to think that when my head got that big, it stopped the sunshine of the Spirit from getting to my heart. And I changed. Started becoming a little important. And as Bill said in his story, I arrived. And Joy and I were going in totally opposite directions. And she's ready to kind of settle down and retire and have an easier life. And I'm wanting to go out and be fast and furious. And so that wasn't going to work together. And we actually split up. We got divorced. Can't really remember the year, but I believe it was 2006 or 7. So we got divorced, and I went out to become a hero. She got more heavily involved in the program and actually started counseling and stuff. So about a year and a half goes by. I'm in Chattanooga, and I bump into this kid that I'd met in a meeting. He had 2 years in the program, another newcomer, and said, you look terrible. You sound terrible. You ought to go to a meeting. Now, you know, at this time, like I said, now I'm about 19 years sober. And who's this wet behind the ears kid to tell me that I need to get to a meeting because I'm not sounding too good, you know? And I said, well, you know, I think I'm fine. He goes, well, why don't you meet me at a meeting tonight? Okay, you know, I'll prove him wrong. And about halfway through that meeting, I realized this kid's right. I'm sick. My head is up you know where and not in the clouds. And so I started going to meetings again. I started getting more heavily involved in Alcoholics Anonymous again. I started practicing these principles and these steps. I started sponsoring people, and I started doing service work. And I went back to being the guy I think that maybe Joy met. And I honestly, truthfully, forgot to sign an alimony check and met her to sign that. And we've talked for 2 or 3 hours. And then we started to talk more and more, and we were apart for about 2 years, and we got back together. So Joy will tell you, I think, that we've been together for 31 years with 2 years off for bad behavior, mine. we've been back together now since 2009 or 10, and our lives have changed dramatically. I think the biggest thing for me in my life is that I continue to try and be of service. And I think that's the thing that keeps us sober when nothing else will. I think when I'm willing to take away from my time to spend it with you for your benefit instead of my own, I benefit probably the most. But it's what keeps me sober. The guys that I sponsor, if you ask me to sponsor you, I will. I'm not the greatest sponsor in the world, but I'll guarantee you I'm not going to tell you no, because you're the one keeping me sober. And why not turn away an opportunity to stay sober another day? I can't think of a reason. I'm also not one of those guys that would tell you don't call me at 2 o'clock in the morning. I hear that. I'm going to be your sponsor, but don't call me after 9. I've never met an alcoholic who had a problem before 9 o'clock. You know? Hey. Those problems show up around 11:30, and they really ride you into about 2 in the morning. And that's when you call, right? You call at 2, because that's when you are trying to make that decision. Am I going to stay sober or not? So I haven't had to call my sponsor at that time of day, but he knows I will. There's no doubt about that. By the way, I do have a home group. It's currently the Mustard Seed Group in Waveland, Mississippi, even though I'm in North Georgia. And my sponsor's name is Bob Carver. He's back in that area in Mississippi. Bob's been sober. I think he's about to celebrate 49 years. And he has been a very easy sponsor and a very tough sponsor. He handed me a sheet of paper with about 8 things on it when I asked him to be my sponsor. And I said, somebody gave me these years ago. He goes, well, I didn't give them to you, so we're going to do them again. And so we did. And he keeps me, he helps keep me grounded. You know, whenever else anything fails, I can call Bob, and Bob knows. Bob knows me, and he knows where I'm coming from. And again, he's the one that insisted that you hear that prison and hairstyling story. The guys that I sponsor, I ask them to make up their bed, and I ask them to be of service. I think it's important to go to meetings. I think it's important to be in big book studies. But I think when nothing else fails, being of service will keep you sober. And when a guy tells me, well, I just can't find any service work, then go to Walmart and bring carts back for the next 4 hours. That cart guy is going to appreciate the hell out of it. He's going to thank you at some point. And you're going to have done something for somebody else. Go wash your neighbor's car if you've got to. Go rake your neighbor's yard. Do it. We're supposed to be of service to each other. I think we're supposed to serve other alcoholics first if we have that opportunity. But I got to tell you, service work's service work. And if it's helping the little old lady that lives next door paint her house, by God, go paint it. If that's what you got to do to keep from taking another drink. Because if you're anything like me, another drink of alcohol is going to lead to death. I know that I've got another drunk in me. I don't know if I've got another sober in me. One of Joy's sponsors used to say that he's closer to his next drink than he is his last. And I believe that is true of me as well. I don't think it's possible for me to always be 100% sure that I'm not going to take a drink. I don't know what it would take. I've been through a lot since I've been sober, and it hasn't taken any of that. But who knows? All it takes is, I heard a guy's story once, and he said, you know, he said, I got up this morning, and I was tying my shoes, and I broke a shoestring, and I said, that's it. And he got drunk. Now, it wasn't a shoestring. It was all the days that preceded him breaking that shoestring, but that shoestring was that last thing. I don't know what that last thing is for me, but it might not be a big thing. And so I need the insurance that I get from doing service with you guys, from coming to meetings, and for keeping my head in this big book. Joy and I have led a lot of big book studies. We've done them in our home. We've done them in treatment centers. We occasionally will go places and do a three-day big book study over the weekend. And it's helped improve our knowledge of not only this program, but of ourselves. And it's helped us, again, give back a little bit. We sold our home about 4 years ago and bought a fifth-wheel RV and moved into it. And we've traveled around the Southeast thus far. And what we do is we go to campgrounds and we volunteer. And we work in the campground for 3 months to a year. The one we've been in now, we've been there a year. We're probably going to be there another one. We like it. They seem to like us. And right now it's a crazy time in our country, and I don't know if I want to travel anyplace else than another where I am right now. So we're kind of staying put, but it's a great way to live, and it gives us the opportunity to be of service to some people that we wouldn't normally get to meet. And it gets us an opportunity to share our sobriety, because you'd be amazed at the number of drunks that pull into campgrounds that don't know they're drunks. You know? They know they've got a drinking problem. They just don't know they're a drunk like us. And I remember my favorite saying was always that I'm a drunk, not an alcoholic, because alcoholics have to go to the meetings, and I didn't have to go to one. Well, guess what? Here I am. I'm at one of them A&A meetings, as my brother-in-law used to say. I am in close contact with my children today, but that wasn't always the case. There was a period of time when I was estranged from my children through efforts of their mother. Today, I have a good relationship with my children. I have a good relationship with Joy's children. And all of our children get along well together, which is also a blessing. I was just going to tell you the secret to, but it's gone. Maybe, you know, there it was. What can I tell you? We've still only got an hour left. So we got wonderful grandchildren as well, and that's a blessing in our lives. We've got a daughter that's now in the program for 7 years. We didn't think she'd live long enough to get 7 years in this program. And there's been time, there was a year's period where we would call the, or Joy would call the police station once a week and say, Have you found a body that looks like my kid? And they're like, no, no body's this week. Or we got a body, but it's not her. And so we went through those terrible periods of worrying about that child, but she is now 7 years sober. You know, the child that we had a problem with, I am the proud father of the only child person I've ever known to get a DUI while on a river ferry crossing the river. Wasn't too long ago, Joy and I were on that ferry, and a guy came over and says, aren't you Brandon's dad? And I said, yes, I am. He goes, I was here tonight. He got the DUI. My boy, you know. They don't make a bumper sticker for that. You know, my kid got arrested on the ferry. But he was one of those kids and just drunk all the time. And I'll tell you one little quick story. He got into a lot of trouble, wound up getting sprayed with mace in his eyes and melting his contacts. His wife was in a coma. Things didn't go well. And when it all got over with and I had a chance to talk to him, I said, son, do you think you know what caused that to happen? And he said, Dad, it's them damn country music bars. I can't go back to country music bars anymore. And I thought, you know, I'm glad you figured it out, buddy. You know, I gave him a big book about 20 years ago, and I'm sure Katrina got it, but he's never read it. But the odd thing happened. About a year ago, he sent me this little spiritual message. And then he sent me this thing. He says, Dad, have you read this book? It's a wonderful book. You should try reading it. And it was Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. And I thought, did you read it? He goes, yeah, I've read it a few times. I wasn't sure you could read. So, you know, go figure. And then there's some other stuff he's reading. And he's not drinking. I don't know if he's just a dry drunk or what's going on, but he's not drinking. He's living a different life. He's behaving differently. When you call him up, he's not complaining. He's talking about the wonderful things in his life. And that's good enough, you know. I would have pronounced him an alcoholic a long time ago. Maybe he was just a hard drinker, you know. Maybe he wasn't a real alcoholic, as our book calls it. And so you just never know. But one thing I do know for sure, if you have children like we did in this program, God doesn't have grandchildren. The same God that's looking over me is looking after my kids, and he sees them as his child. He doesn't see them as mine. And so I never know what it's going to take for one of my kids to find this program or to change the way that they're living. But, you know, it's not my business. My business is to be the best dad that I can possibly be, to be the best husband that I can possibly be. And the way that I get to do that is by being the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can possibly be. Some days that's great. Some days it's not so good. Most importantly, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come up here and do this, and thank you for taking the time and for listening. If maybe there's something I've told you that you can take home, I will tell you that if you hear me say the story differently next time, it doesn't mean I lied. It just means I understood it differently than I understand it now. Thank you again for the opportunity. Have a great weekend.